particular body where they can tap into the sky and the air, the potencies that are there, the energies that are there, and they can fly, you know, as high as tall trees. Others have a different, you know, body, and they can fly practically above the clouds. So, you know, there is a combination of the particular body that one has, coupled with the, you know, potencies that are there within the sky, within the air, gives one the abilities to, so the yogis, they gradually develop the ability to tap into these various, you know, energies. So, on Siddha Loka and Vidyadhara Loka, you know, the bodies that they have are suitable for flying in the to the highest degree. So, you know, there is a combination of the particular body and how the subtle and the gross body that we have and how that is developed, and the potencies that are there within the atmosphere of the air, or, you know, within the earth. So it appears that the earth is able to supply or withdraw the, you know, potencies that are there within the air or the sky. So what it's saying here is that even though these personalities may have had the same bodies, that because the earth was not producing, therefore, you know, the bodies themselves are not lacking the capabilities that they previously had. it is a similar situation to the citizens who first approached Prithvi Maharaj, that just to perform their usual work, you know, as human beings, you know, some producing food, some managing, you know, some building, some, you know. But they didn't have the physical or mental capabilities. They were actually so, that because the earth had withdrawn some of their necessities for their usual activities. So although the body was there, the body was somewhat lacking, and at the same time, the body needed to depend upon certain productions from the earth. So it is the same principle all the way up to these subtle planets. You know, here the Vidyadhara Loka, Siddha Lokas. There is a production from Bhumi itself. There's a verse in the Bhagavad Gita, third chapter. Anyone got a Gita here? Got a Bhagavad Gita? Yeah, okay. Third chapter. In the beginning of creation, the Lord of all creatures sent forth generations of men and demigods and blessed them by saying, "Be thou happy by this jagya. By its performance, all necessities of life will be provided." Can you?
7, verse 10.
10? Yeah, read them both, yeah.
Sahajya prajasrishva puru vatya prajapati anena prasavishvetam esha uskrishva kamadu. In the beginning of creation, the Lord of all creatures sent forth generations of men and demigods along with sacrifices for Vishnu and blessed them by saying, "Be thou happy by this yajna sacrifice, because its performance will bestow upon you everything desirable for living happily and achieving liberation.
Mm. So the yajna is good for men and demigods. And what is the next verse?
The demigods, being pleased by sacrifices, will also please you. And thus, by cooperation between men and demigods, prosperity will reign for all.
Right. So these verses are describing that, you know, the demigods depend upon yajna. They become pleased by yajna. And then when there is yajna, everything is properly produced, both for the men and demigods. And the demigods, you know, make sure that the mankind who is performing the yajnas have the adequate requirements, and the demigods are taking their results from the performance of yajna. So everyone is being satisfied, both the demigods and men, you know. So you know, your question, Ananta Virya, that, you know, from the other day, you were saying that, you know, it would appear that the demigods, you know, they have some connection with the earth, you know. Mm. So, you know, that is answered there in the Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah. They're satisfied by the sacrifices.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah,
and they also, as described here, there is some dependence upon the earth.
Mm-hmm.
For, you know, some of the necessities of the demigods. In other words, you know, we're getting an indication that, for instance, if the demigods decided that, you know, we are, you know, who cares what they do on earth, you know, let them go to hell, let them perform yajnas, whatever they want to do, who cares. You know, we live in the heavenly planets, let's just enjoy all facility, and, you know, we'll not really do the work that we're meant to do for, you know, Vishnu. Then they would also, they cannot do that. They must, you know, for their own benefit, also make sure that yajnas are performed. You know, it's... you know, they're not. It's the universe is set up in such a way that you know, there's an interdependence between the earth, the yajna is being performed, the earth producing, and the demigods, you know, rewarding the results of yajna, but they're also receiving benefits from yajna, and many of those benefits are actually coming from Bhumi herself, from the earth.
So you could progress from there to the spiritual side.
You can go to the spiritual world from anywhere. It's not dependent upon any material conditions. Yeah.
So you're still kind of, I guess, because of what we're talking about, reminded that yoga is important and devotion to friends is important, because otherwise there's still limitations. So that you, like, you're not completely forgetful, because it's not just all enjoyment, that requirement's still there in the heavenly.
Yes, but the... you know, here, both the humans who are performing yajna and the demigods who are encouraging the system of yajna, disseminating knowledge and rewarding those who perform yajna and punishing those who don't and what have you. They're both somewhat self-serving. You know, it's different from bhakti.
Yeah.
Here we see that the demigods have an understanding that if yajna is not performed, they will not get certain material facilities, whether they be subtle or for the earth planet more gross in the sense of physical food to eat, shelter, rain, but they're both an understanding there that if I don't perform this activity to Vishnu, then there'll be problems and there'll be a reduction of the facilities we need. So that's not bhakti. But one can develop bhakti. The benefit of this system is that all of these persons come under the shelter of the Vedas. And because they come under the shelter of the Vedas, it means that gradually as they become purified, they can take higher knowledge from the same body of knowledge. You see? So they're having faith in the Vedas. The Vedas are describing that this universe works in a certain way, where there's cooperation between the demigods and humans. And they've learnt that from the Vedas, both the demigods and humans, and they've learnt the process of yajna, worshipping the Vishnu. And so they understand that everything is being maintained by that Vedic instruction. So therefore they have faith in the Vedas. Therefore when the Vedas teach something a little more difficult to understand, there's a possibility they may accept that because they also already have faith in that body of knowledge. So then the Vedas will instruct them that beyond this material world, which you're all taking as all in all, there is a spiritual abode. See, that's more difficult to understand. And to get there, one has to surrender to the Supreme Lord. Now that's even more difficult, Surrender everything. So with a bit of association with devotees, there's a chance that they'll be able to take the next sort of step in that direction. If they don't, then basically everything they're doing is a useless waste of time. Yeah. It's there, but it's the atmosphere of material enjoyment is so enticing that it's difficult to sort of drag oneself away from the the abundant sense enjoyment and the illusion and what have you. It's more difficult, much more difficult. It's something like say a person who has a problem with their weight and they're trying to lose weight, and they work in a cake shop. It's they're really It's going to make it difficult, isn't it? So they might desire a job next door, you know, where it's like, you know, they sell bicycle parts or something, you know.
But there's just a cake shop next door too.
Well, they might want to go to the right down the street, the end of the street, you know, like that. So.
But basically, this kind of interrelation we find between the earth and the devas to bring all of them under the shelter of the Vedas. Is that, do I understand you right?
Yeah.
So, as in the humans and demigods to ultimately take shelter of the Vedas and Krishna.
Yes, it's to bring, yes.
And of course, it says in some purport, supplying all necessities through the medium of earth.
So, you know, in the heavenly planets, they don't accrue karma. You know, they have whatever good karma, punya karma, whatever karma they have from pious activities, that has allowed them to you know, take a heavenly body and a heavenly thing. When that karma is used up, they then descend to earth after, you know, millions of years of our time, or tens of thousands. But they don't accrue karma. Similarly, in the lower planetary systems, they don't accrue karma. Whatever sinful activities, impious activities, they have accrued that has made them take birth in those planets. When that is used up, then they may take birth again in the middle planetary system, the earthly planetary system.
But one or the other, or can there be that concept that you can be in multiple dimensions at the same time?
One or the other.
Well,
yeah. Although, you know, there are some beings who are able to freely travel through, you know, any planet they like. You know. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, you know, you might have someone from Interpol or something. You know, they can. They can go into the prisons, they can go into, you know, the government offices, they can go to, you know, anywhere they like, you know, that they have access to. So, you know, there are some living entities who can move freely, they have free access to anywhere, and according to the business that they're doing, they can go there. But others, you know, according to their karma, you know, they are take a body and they are limited to that realm by that particular body that they have, and whether it be subtle or gross body.
But are you referring to like Narada Muni,
Narada Muni, and there are various sages such as Narada Muni. Yeah. Narada Muni is quite special because he can actually even go to Vaikuntha. But that's quite rare. Vaikuntha means he actually leaves the material universe and go to the spiritual planets.
And are there other souls that could permanently travel to different places?
Yeah.
But all in the material anyway.
Yeah, usually the ones that can travel somewhat detached, more detached, so they don't tend to stay permanently in one place. You know, they have, when you have that option that you can go anywhere you like, they generally use it.
And you know?
What's
that?
What's that?
That
is, well, you know, these are generally great sages. Who some of them have acquired mystic perfections. Some of them are yogis who have acquired mystic perfections. One of the mystic perfections is that they can actually capture the sun rays and travel to the sun. Or they can capture the moon rays and travel to the moon. I was once with a friend of mine. There's plenty of little stories I had, but anyway, back in our wasted years, we went to Cape Schanck, which is, I don't know if anyone's been there, it's like back at Flinders, out down the Mornington Peninsula on the back beaches, and there's some big cliffs there. When I was a teenager, I put the walking track in there with about eight other boys. We built that walking track and all the fences along there and, you know, the access and like that. So I used to go there as a favourite walk. I used to like to go there in the wee hours of the morning on a full moon night. You know, we might have collected the odd magic mushroom on the way. But so anyway, one time here we were walking and he said to me, I've just gone to the moon and back. And I said, because he was dreaming. How did you do that? He said, I captured the moon beams. And I went, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know where he got it from. But I knew he hadn't, because he was sort of, I saw him standing. You know, it was all within his mind. But, you know, he felt that he had. But he was tripping. But the yogis actually do it. And they can just, you know, go there. They just capture the...
Without
the mushrooms.
And also, but to keep doing that, they have to keep their
sadhana up. If they lose their spiritual potency by not practicing, by falling down from their yogic practices, yes, they can actually, their mystic powers can decline. They can also, their mystic powers can be used up by, you know, utilizing them for, you know, just sense enjoyment and impious, you know, activities. So they can, even yogis who may have the ability to travel from planet to planet, if they become very sinful, then they can suffer, you know, sinful reactions and their mystic potencies can be removed. You know, we had the example of that with what's his name? I forget his name. He was in about a couple of hundred years ago, within the time of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and he declared that he was Vishnu. And he was a very powerful mystic yogi. This story is actually mentioned in the Indian newspapers as well, because it happened when Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who was the great spiritual master, so the guru of Prabhupada's guru, in fact he was the father of Prabhupada's guru, he was a magistrate of Puri, Jagannath Puri, and he was also the superintendent of the temple there. And a yogi, who was a very, very powerful yogi, declared that he was God. And so he had the ability that, you know, he could make fire come from his eyes and from his hair. So he's very, you know, a very, very powerful person. If people went against him, he would make them very, very sick, you know, practically fatally ill if he wanted. So people were very scared of him. And but what happened was that when he started imitating Krishna, and, you know, he was alluring the men's wives and having, you know, sex with them, and then they all complained, you know, that he has this ability and he's using it for, you know, sense gratification, and he's declaring that he's God. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur went to him, and discuss with him, and then, you know, to see when he got there, you know, this yogi was saying, I know who you are and I know why you're here, like that, you know. And he offered him, you come and, you know, you work with me and you can be, you know, very powerful. I will make you a powerful ruler and all this sort of. So Bhaktivinoda Kaur said that you think are you God? Yes. Well then, why don't you come to the temple? You know, if that is, if you're God, then you come to Jagannath temple, people will come and worship you. And he said, no, this Jagannath in the temple, he's just a lump of wood. So then he understood, well, you are not God, because, you know, this is, Jagannath is not wood, he's, the deity of the Lord. So then he had his men arrested him. So then that yogi there was a court case, it went for 18 days, and during that, the yogi fasted. And every day, Bhaktivinoda Kaur and his family and his children becoming sicker, and, you know, like to the point where they feared that they were going to die. And I think at one stage they actually had to carry Bhaktivinoda Kaur in on the stretcher, like he was so ill. And anyway, Prabhupada says, Bhaktivinoda Kaur said, you cut off his hair. And they cut the yogi's hair off, and then he just collapsed, because he'd been fasting, you know, for the whole time of this court case, you know, and utilizing this yogic strength. But then when because yogis, they can keep their mystic strength within their locks of hair, like Samson, you know, you hear about Samson in the Bible, he was like a yogi, and his mother told him when he was born that, some sages had told her, don't ever let him cut his hair, because it's the best strength. And Delilah, of course, tricked him. And, you know. So, you know, they cut off his hair, and then he just collapsed. He was a very, very powerful yogi. He just collapsed, and then they put him in jail. He got sentenced to a year or two in jail. And after about 6 months, he took poison and died. So, you know, here's a yogi who had great power that literally suffered very severe reactions by, you know. So, yes, you know, it is possible that, you know, yogis can utilize their, you know, perfections in order to get good association with great personalities and incarnations of the Lord. But if they use it for sense gratification, they can actually lose that mystic potency. And, you know, suffer severe sinful reactions in the
life.
Like self-serving. You know. So they may take birth as very powerful living beings, but, you know, in a very wretched condition. So, you know, or they may be dispatched to the lower planetary systems, because in the lower planetary systems also some of them have these great powers. Prabhupada mentions here about the there's also, it says the next verse, it says others also, the inhabitants of the planets known as Kim Purusha Loka, made the demon Maya into a calf, and they milked out mystic powers by which one can disappear immediately from another's vision and appear again in a different form. Now, Prabhupada mentions in this purport that, you know, the inhabitants of this planet can do whatever they like or whatever they imagine. Such powers are also mystic powers. This is called Ishita. The demons generally learn such mystic powers by the practice of yoga. Right? But in some planets, these powers are again natural, that they have them. They don't have to practice yoga. They're natural because they've been yogis perhaps in previous lifetimes, but because they got somewhat of a demoniac nature. So Prabhupada says in the Dashama Skanda, the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, there's a vivid description of how the demons appear before Krishna in various wonderful forms. For instance, Bakasura appeared before Krishna and his cowherd boyfriends as a gigantic crane. You see? So, while present on this planet, Lord Krishna had to fight with many demons who could exhibit the wonderful mystic powers of Kim Purusha Loka. So, you know, therefore, some yogis may be elevated, and some may end up on planets where they have mystic powers, but they may also have somewhat of a demoniac nature.
Basically, because if they were yogis on this bad, but they misuse their
power. Yeah, they still have that mischievous nature, you know.
Or they might get a little addicted to pious
activities. Yeah, yeah. So just being a yogi in itself, you know, so there are various...
So, now, on a different note, when you say that, of course, there's no karma accumulation in heavenly planets, for example, but then, say, kings like Indra, demigods, if they, you know, he has committed so many sinful acts, so would he also have to suffer with that?
They can get reaction from offences.
Yeah.
Generally, it's not so much, it's not karma, but they can offend. They can cause offences. So quite often you see that Indra may suffer the reaction of offences.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not karma. No. So, therefore, you know, when you perform yajna, what happens, of course, is that in that Bhagavad Gita, it describes that work binds one to, you know, what is that slope? Is that text number 9? Do you read text number 9 of the Bhagavad Gita?
Work done as a sacrifice for Vishnu has to be performed. Otherwise, work causes bondage in this material world. Therefore, O son of Kunti, perform your prescribed duties for his satisfaction, and in that way you will always remain free from bondage.
Mm. So, I mean, you know, the demigods are not bound by the, you know, they're not performing activities which causes karma, nor in the lower planetary system. So yajna, you know, which benefits the whole universe, but it is especially here we are bound in this middle planet. It is here in the earth, you know, system that we become bound by the works of our action. So it is here particularly that yajna should be performed. Everyone should worship the Supreme Lord, but, you know, yajna is especially to perform in this earthly planetary system, because this is where we're bound by the actions. So therefore, you know, this earthly planetary system is a special place for performing yajna for those who are bound, do accrue karma, but by the performance of that yajna, the demigods also benefit, all living entities throughout the universe benefit, acquiring various necessities that are needed with the, you know, the earth planetary system being somewhat essential for some of the, you know, if not necessarily all of the facilities are coming from the earthly planetary system, but certainly the earth, Bhumi, is producing some of the essential, you know, like, you know, what is the use of living in Vidyadhara Loka or Siddha Loka if you cannot fly, you know.
Yeah.
Well, it depends to the extent, you know. Here, the Earth planet, sometimes, you know, when there is jagyu is not being performed to a certain degree, then the residents of the Earth themselves, you know, may suffer in different regions or areas. You know, it appears at this stage that the Earth was reducing or, you know, withholding to the degree that it actually affected residents in other planetary systems. So that's not always the case. But in this case, it appears that she actually there was such a lack of jagya that you know, things were restricted to the point where those residents of other planetary systems were being deprived of some of the essential necessities that they depend upon, which, you know, is connected to the performance of jagya. Yeah.
But that could happen to that, like say, because there's so much, there's practically no sacrifice except for these sankirtan yagyas. Is that the reason why demigods cannot fly into, you know like I think it's expanding on your question.
Yeah, no, they just they don't come in Kali Yuga. They don't.
Well, so it's not necessarily that they don't have any powers.
No, no. Yeah, they don't come. But in the last Kali Yuga, the Kali Yuga, you know, at the very end of universal creation, certainly everything is withdrawn completely. So much so that it affects the whole universe.
So not
oh, that's a long time.
At the end of 14th month.
Yeah, at the end of the 14th month. Yeah. That's a different.
Yeah. That seems to be into connectedness. Like that theory of as above, so below, there's some kind of connection that one part affects the other.
Yes, yeah. You know, as they say, if your fence is, if your neighbour's fence is on fire, that means your fence is on fire. Oh, next, yeah. You say, oh, next door's fence is on fire. That's our fence too. It's like that.
So the model is just get out of the material.
Of course.
Yeah. But while we're here, we have to cooperate, and that cooperation is done by we in the earthly planetary system. They must perform jagyas, and those in the higher planetary system are responsible for encouraging the system of jagya. And encouraging, you know, people to follow the knowledge of the Vedas or those literatures which, you know, are pursuant to the knowledge of the Vedas. And the demigods are also responsible to make sure that if people have performed jagyas, that, you know, they are allocated the necessities because... you know, just as, you know, if people have paid their taxes, you know, all the government ministers, you know, they're responsible to make sure that, okay, all these people properly paid their taxes, therefore there has to be, you know, sufficient, you know, proper management. You know, Prabhupada was saying about England, I'm not sure if it's like that now, but, you know, so this is back in the 70s, Srila Prabhupada was saying that although England has lost their empire, actually they're very good managers. Because, you know, at that time in England, he said practically all they produce in England is potatoes. They don't really produce anything else, just potatoes. He said, but they're able to manage in such a way that nearly everything is imported. And the people in England, you know, pretty much had all the requirements of food in all the different varieties. There was free health, free education, there were, you know, so many different things. It's coming back sometimes. So, you know, he was considering that, you know, the proper management was there. So if people pay their taxes and the ministers and the government manages properly, everything should be provided. That they should do that very expertly. So that's the job of the demigods, to make sure, to expertly to provide and allocate everything. Like that. So, and then, you know, people are encouraged. Yes, we did pay taxes, and we see that everything is nicely done. And people perform yagyas, and they see, yes, all the facility is nicely there. It's the same management system that you see here on Earth. You know, it is the same thing. Those who are collecting taxes, so the yagyas in one sense is like, you know, when you pay taxes, it means that a person acknowledges the government, right? Because a person who doesn't acknowledge the government, they never pay taxes. You know, I'm like, you know, I'm not paying anything to those rascals, you know. So they acknowledge that, you know, I'm paying taxes, this is a legitimate government. These are the people you give money to because they are the ones managing, therefore I'm paying them. I'm not paying these ones taxes because they're not the legitimate government. So acknowledging a legitimate government and you acknowledging that they're capable of looking after the necessities. So, you know, the average citizens, they can't, when we want to go somewhere, we can't lay our own railroad. Oh, you know, I want to go to the other side, so I have to lay my own railroad and build a train, and someone broke into my house, I might have to train up my own policeman. You know, these things are done. We can't do all these things. You know, I'm a bit sick, I'll have to build a hospital and train some people. You know, these things are all done by the government. They're just things that the average citizen can't do. So similarly, you actually need demigods with certain power and facility that, you know, create facility that we just can't create as individuals or communities. So yagyas are a way of acknowledging that. But in the same way that the government can't perform its duty if they don't get their taxes. You know, if people don't pay their taxes, the government can't, even though they may be very expert managers, they can't actually... They need the citizens to cooperate. So the demigods are like that. If the yagyas are not performed, they're also lacking the facility and the powers. This is what's sort of being pointed out. So therefore, you know, this earthly planetary system is like that, is where, you know, the yagyas are performed, that goes to the demigods. It acknowledges the government, which is under the supreme authority of the Prime Minister, or the, you know, which is Vishnu, who is, you know, the God of gods, Deva Deva, Lord of lords. He is above all the demigods like this, so we acknowledge the demigods are acting. So all this information, by performing yagya, the average person picks up so much information. Just like the average citizen, when they get to 18 or 16, 17, and then the parents start telling them, you're going to have to start paying taxes soon. And they start to think, well, you know, about government and who's running and who's the prime minister and how do things work. Before that, they don't care. It's like, you know, Friday night, let's go party, you know, where's the keys to the car, mum? Like that. They start to have to pay taxes, means they have to think in a certain way. Well, what am I getting for this money? Like that, you know. So when people perform yagya, they start to think, well, who's managing? Why is this? And they start to understand. So, You know, it gives them knowledge. But ultimately, it is, you know, producing the facility that they require, including the knowledge of the Vedas, which mostly deals with the three modes of material nature. And therefore, in the Bhagavad Gita, what is that? Chapter 2? Chapter 2, is it? Text number 53. What is it? Yeah, Trigunya, Visha, Veda, Nistrigunya, Pavajina, Idvandva, Nichasatvasto. Is that it?
45? I
think so. Yeah. 45,
yeah. The Veda is dealing mainly with the subject of the three modes of material nature. O Arjuna, become transcendental to these three modes. Be free from all dualities and from all anxieties for gain and safety, and be established in the self.
Yeah. So, you know, through the system of Jagya, they gradually take an interest and have access through the brahmanas, those who are performing, the brahmanas. They engage people in Jagya. And the brahmanas have studied the reason, behind, the purpose behind Jagya. So gradually as they perform Jagya under the direction of the brahmanas, they learn the purpose behind them. But mostly their material purposes, dealing with the three modes of material nature. But at least it puts them under the authority of the Vedas. But gradually, as you know, when you come to the Bhagavad Gita, here, at a certain point, when one needs to come to a spiritual understanding as the ultimate solution to, material existence, one has to rise above all the different Vedic injunctions dealing with just the Jagya, just for the material necessity, just for cooperating between the demigods and humans. One has to rise above that to the sections of the Vedas which deal with transcendence, and that's the Upanishads. And the Upanishads deal with, Brahman, the subject of spirit. And, one who has performed jagyas, for many, many lifetimes, perform many, jagyas means that a person is always performing pious activities and a person is not performing impious activities. And if there is some impiety, accidentally, incidentally, or what have you, it is burned up by the performance of jagya. So, after becoming pure, performing pious activities for many lifetimes and becoming free from impious activities, one gets some steadiness to approach spiritual subject matters, and of course, one gets some steadiness to take up, service to the Supreme Lord, bhakti. Bhakti means that there is Bhagavan, who is the Lord, who is served. There is the bhakta, because we are part and parcel of the whole, so we are the servant. And there is bhakti, the interaction of love. So there's Bhagavan, the Supreme Lord, the Bhakta, and the interaction of love is called Bhakti. they are all transcendental. Bhagavan, Bhakti, Bhakta are transcendental. These are above the modes of material nature. One has to first, go beyond the Vedic injunctions dealing with the modes of material nature, dealing with just producing the necessities, material necessities of life. But that takes many lifetimes of performing yajna. It brings one to that platform of piety and stops the impiety, the sinful desires and sinful mischievousness. Therefore there's that verse in the Bhagavad Gita, 7:27.
Persons who have acted piously in previous lives and in this life, and whose sinful actions are completely eradicated, are freed from the dualities of delusion, and they engage themselves in my service with determination.
So this performance of yajna brings you to that platform. Then one can actually engage in the service of the Lord with some determination. It takes many lifetimes of yajna. And at that point, a person has some, then with good association, they develop some faith that they're thinking, up until this point they're thinking, now I'm performing yajna and I'm getting lots of rain, the wheat is growing, the grass is growing, the cows are, got full milk udders, and I'm trading, some milk, and I'm getting saris from my, wife and family, and get a nice little hut here, and that land, and we're performing the different yajnas. Everything is all the material, so like that. Gradually, they understand that, they may, within the course of yajnas, there are so many demigods that are worshipped, and ultimately Vishnu is the supreme recipient of yajna. He enjoys the results of that yajna, and then all the demigods accept the yajna prasad, and they are awarded their allocation, as we're seeing in these chapters here. All the everything is provided to them, plus they get the yajna prasad. And then the demigods, being satisfied, they also make sure the humans who perform yajna get what they want. So then gradually people understand that, it is this Vishnu that if he, it's up to him, that he will say to the demigods, yes, give or don't give. So therefore, if you just please Vishnu, who is the root of all existence, then all the demigods are satisfied. These are the Om Tad Vishnu Paramam Padam Sada Pachanti Suryam. One understands if you just water the root of the tree, all the branches and leaves, everything is, gets the nutrition. There's no need to. So this understanding gradually comes. So then, one comes to understand. So therefore, to please that Supreme Lord, that is bhakti, to serve, to satisfy. if one has a loving relationship with that Supreme Person, then automatically all the demigods, you don't have to satisfy them, by Vishnu's grace, because he is controlling all the demigods, everything is provided. So therefore an understanding comes, and I just surrender to that one person. Who is that Vishnu? Oh, he is expansion of Narayan. Narayan is expansion from Krishna. Just by worshipping Krishna, all the demigods are automatically pleased. That Shraddha or faith, manifests after many, many lifetimes of yajna. And then, if one continues to serve that Supreme Lord, which is, you know, transcendental piety, and by serving him it means that one's also not committing sinful activities. that fixes one in one's determination. Then one becomes fixed in that determination. and then by associating with those who are similarly fixed in that determination, that Shraddha or that faith is maintained and it grows. You can actually water that Shraddha and it grows, become very, very powerful, very unshakable faith in the Supreme.
These sacrifices by themselves, they are still in the mode of material goodness, isn't it?
Yeah, generally.
And to come to devotional service after living your lifetime, but isn't that with the mercy of a devotee? That's what
yeah. So what happens is that, again, by performance of yajna, one gets a general understanding how the universe is working with the demigods under that one Supreme Lord. One understands gradually that by then, just by focusing on serving that Supreme Lord, all the demigods are automatically satisfied. One may associate with devotees, they're called Vaishnavas, one who worships Vishnu or, you know, the various forms of Vishnu, they're called Vaishnava. Vaishnava actually means one who exclusively serves the Lord. In other words, if someone says, I am a Vaishnava, but I also worship Ganesh and Shiva and Durga, it means that they're not a Vaishnava because they haven't understood that just by serving Vishnu, there's no need to separately serve Durga, Ganesh, Surya, Brahma, Indra, like that. Vaishnava means they've understood that principle. Oh, you just serve Vishnu, automatically all the demigods are satisfied. If someone says, yes, I also worship Vishnu and Krishna, and I worship Ganesh, and that means they're not a Vaishnava. But, you know, they may call themselves a Vaishnava because they, amongst all the demigods they worship, somewhere there's a picture of Vishnu and Krishna as well. But they're not actually a Vaishnava. Vaishnava means they actually have that faith. They only have to exclusively worship Vishnu. In the same way that when you water a tree, you only have to water the root. You do not have to separately water the twigs and the leaves and the branches. That's not necessary. That person has a proper understanding. If someone is saying, yes, I water the root and the branches and this twig and this, that means they haven't understood, even though they're doing the same thing. Yeah. So.
Atheistic, it's the broad cover insurance policy.
Hedging your bets.
Worship all gods, one lady here.
So, then one may want to associate with Vaishnavas. Oh, what, you know, someone, you know the art, you have learned the art of how to fully satisfy Vishnu, or Krishna, the source of Vishnu. What is that art? That is called bhakti. That is bhakti. if one worships Vishnu and other demigods, it's not bhakti. There's no bhakti. It's only bhakti when one exclusively serves Vishnu and that service is done for the satisfaction of for spiritual purposes. If we worship Vishnu for material purposes, it's also not bhakti.
Yep. But they
Yes, yeah. But it's not, yeah.
Thinking a lot about it,
yeah, yeah. As we were saying, bhakti, there are many people who say that they're bhaktas. Yeah, we also do bhakti yoga and this and that. And we're also Vaishnavas, and yes, we're also Krishna bhaktas and what have you. As we say, you know, if someone says, yes, I understand that if you water the root of the tree, that everything is done. So I also water the root of the tree and the branches and the twigs. It means they haven't really understood, doesn't it? You know.
Mm-hmm.
So they, whereas a bhakta has, a Vaishnava has, they've understood that principle. Mm-hmm. That the root of all creation, when one is connected in a loving relationship, that is sufficient. A bhakta has that understanding. That's called shraddha or faith. One who has that faith, yes, by that service to the root of all creation, Vishnu, Krishna, everything is satisfied. That's called faith, a shraddha. It's very strong. It's strong enough that one can neglect the worship of other demigods. Because generally, if one is accustomed, there's family tradition, there may be, as we read here in the Bhagavad Gita, that Krishna is saying to Arjuna, we accept the authority of the Vedas, Arjuna, but not, you know, the majority of us dealing with the most material nature. Now I want you to rise above that, put that aside. Now that's very difficult, for people. So shraddha means it's very strong, even in the beginning. Even the first stages of shraddha has to be very strong. It has to have that strength that I'm putting aside worship of all other demigods, all other processes, because I understand the principle that just by worshipping the root of all creation, all creation is satisfied. If that shraddha is not there, then shraddha is the seed of bhakti. From that, love can grow with, you know, the Supreme Lord. If that seed is not there, that creeper of love or bhakti will not grow. So therefore, if one does not have that faith to the strength where one can neglect all other forms of worship and just exclusive, then that means even the very seed of bhakti has not manifest.
If they feel like they followed everything like in the sheet of computer and they developed this great faith and love for Shiva, that's not called any form of Shiva bhakti, or I don't know.
It's not bhakti at all. Yeah. Bhakti is love. Otherwise, it is it's business. It's business that we worship a particular demigod for some particular benefit. For ourselves. If we don't require something from that demigod, then there's no worship. And if somehow the benefits are not forthcoming, then we don't worship. Whereas bhakti is entirely different. So you see that with Arjuna and the Pandavas, they didn't worship Krishna when there was a problem. They, whether there was a problem or no problem, at all stages, causelessly, they always acted for, out of love for Krishna, for his pleasure. And even they were banished to the forest for, 14 years. Draupadi was disrobed, insulted, their kingdoms were taken from them. And they never ever said, Krishna, we have so much problem, please help us, please fix this problem. They never said that. They didn't ask Krishna for anything. And therefore, you know, Prabhupada tells a story about, you know, to indicate the nature of bhakti is the story of Rupa Goswami and Sanatana Goswami, that Rupa Goswami, these were the direct disciples of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, so 500 years ago they lived in Vrindavan, and of course they were sent there by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to excavate all the lost places of pilgrimage, lost places of Krishna's pastime. So when they went there, there were no temples. Now, of course, Vrindavan, there's thousands of temples and all the holy places. So that is their work. By investigating the scriptures and everything, they uncovered the whole land of Vrindavan. So Sanatana Goswami was the elder brother of Rupa Goswami, and Rupa decided that my elder brother is such a nice devotee that I would like to do something nice for him. I'd like to, you know, make some nice prasad, offer some prasad, you know, offer prasad to Krishna and give him some nice food. You know, things that he's always performing some austerity. So anyway, he was thinking like that. At some stage after that, this very beautiful young girl came past, and she said, "Oh, you know, Babaji, Swamiji, there's, you know, we performed some religious ceremony and there's so many things left over, some ingredients, and, you know, perhaps you might like to use these." And he was thinking, oh, you know, this is good. I was just thinking like this. You know, he cooked because, you know, all the Goswamis, they were very expert cooks. Practically all devotees are, you know, expert cooks. And so he cooked, you know, nice, beautiful meal, very elaborate, and then invited Sanatana Goswami. And Sanatana Goswami was, you know, enjoying this. And then you know, he was thinking, you know, where did you get this, you know, the ingredients for this, you know, nice feast like this? And so then Rupa described this young girl, and Sanatana inquired more about this beautiful young girl, and then he understood, well, that is Radharani. You know, Radharani has actually come and personally delivered all these foodstuffs to you. And then he was very angry. You know, what have you done to me? You know, practically my life is finished. Because, you know, my whole existence is dedicated to giving, serving Radharani, and you've made me take something from her. And he was furious about that. So the relationship, but that story shows the relationship between Krishna and Radharani and the devotee. That the devotees, they're always looking for the opportunity to give or to serve or satisfy the Supreme Lord. And they will not accept anything back. But Krishna and Radharani, they're always looking for the opportunity to serve the devotee. So there's a competition. Like that, you know. It's based on love. You know, it's a loving, and that way the devotee is always being satisfied by the Supreme Lord and his spiritual energy, Radharani. Even though they're not wanting anything, and the Lord is always being satisfied, even though he's, you know. So this is, that's bhakti. When you're praying to a demigod for some particular potency, you know, knowledge, this, that, or the other, you're wanting to derive something from. That's not bhakti. That's, you know, you're doing some business. I will worship you in this way. You will give me this and that.
Thank you.
So, but you know, so here we're seeing about yajna, how it is extremely significant for this earthly planetary system. But it is being managed by the demigods, and all living entities throughout the universe are benefiting by this system. Any other questions or comments? So. to just read the last few. So then, the yakshas, rakshasas, ghosts and witches who are habituated to eating flesh transform Lord Shiva's incarnation Rudra, Bhutanath, into a calf and milked out beverages made of blood and put them in a pot made of skulls. So we see that, you know, here they eat flesh and fermented blood. But is that, there's that black pudding? Black pudding. Do you know what black pudding is? No. Black pudding is, it's a sausage made from dried blood, basically, isn't it? Is it pig's blood? Yeah. It's called black pudding, especially the people there. But,
put it into the intestine.
Yes. Oh, you could wrap it up in the intestine as well. Yeah. Well, just like here, they it does. Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, you sort of here they're saying the fermented blood, it's all kept in a, you know, a skull. I mean, you know, we all know there's nothing like drinking fermented blood out of a skull, right? You know, what else would you drink it out of? Yeah. You see, you know, but you know, you see people, they have those rings, you go into the ring shops and, you know, they have the skulls. You see? You know, and they're attracted, and, you know, bikies and, you know, people like that, they're attracted to these things.
So what's
Well, you know, here, there are many living entities, actually, in the same way that a government provides not only for the honest citizens, but, you know, all living entities, you know, we see that snakes are looked after, you know, you're not allowed to kill snakes, you know, they're protected, even though they just want to go, they're full of poison, they just want to bite and kill people. Still, you know, it's against the law to, you know, it's up to the state to look after all living entities. You know, the, generally the government, previously anyway, but more and more the government are becoming like thugs and rogues. But, you know, previously there was a big distinction and the governments didn't like people to have too much intoxication or, you know, what have you. But they still look after to make sure that, you know, those who want to drink intoxication, that they had their hotels and there were certain rules and regulations like that. So, you know, it's not that they're encouraging everyone, yeah, drink, but they're, you know, there are those classes who want to do it. There are classes of people who see prostitutes, you know, so, you know, there are, you know, there are people who are, you know, murderers and what have you. They're also, you know, they're provided their food. I mean, they may be in prison, but still they're provided their eatables and what and everything. So there is a certain you know, duty of care of the government to look after what they call praja. Praja means everyone born is a citizen. So in the Vedic conception, anyone who takes birth is practically a citizen, you know. Here, a citizen is like a human or, you know, like that, or someone who's born in the country. But in the Vedic conception, praja means, you know, one who takes birth. That means any living entity that takes birth, even from, you know, good or bad qualities, there's an onus of the government to look after them, to protect them, to that, their rights. To a certain degree. So here, even, you know, the ghosts, the witches, the rakshasas, they're also provided some of the basic supplements. And of course, we all know that, you know, if you're a rakshasa, you know, you have to, some of your basic requirements is some fermented blood and flesh. Well, you know, yeah.
Say, there's a lama who was leaving food out for the hungry girls after he finished.
Who was that?
The lama.
Yes.
Ceremony to Tara, and then all the discarded offerings the next day were put out.
That's right.
For the hungry girls. Yeah. And
said,
well, you know,
that's right. We also do Bhumi Puja, which is, you know, when a person is going to build a house on a property. So Bhumi, of course, is, refers to the earth. So we worship the there's on each property you draw a grid of what is it? There's 16 squares, or you can do it 64 or something. But and the Jagya Purush, the presiding deity on that piece of land, resides there. He has his head somewhere here and his legs there, sort of on his back. And when you build a house, you don't want to put your house on on his head. Yep. So, a Bhumi Puja is performed where one worships the Lord, but one also offers foodstuffs which are offered to the Lord, so prasadam, to the Buddhas, to the ghosts, you know, snakes, and all the creatures that reside there on that land, or who may take up residence in the, you know, something is offered for them as well.
Mm-hmm. That's good to know, because build a house and who do you do some kind of ceremony?
Give me a call.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We do that. Yeah. We can.
How do you know who the Jagya Purush is?
If you, you know, in the shop there they have some books on Vastu, and you should be able to see, they should have the picture in there. And how to draw up the grid of the block and where the Jagya Purush lays, you know.
Oh, so there'll be a Jagya Purush in
every block. Every block, yeah. So you draw up the grid and you can see, you know, he lays in a certain direction. You can see where his head is, his legs, and like that. And, you know, the south, east, it is ruled by fire. The southwest is ruled by earth. The north west is ruled by air. The north east is ruled by water, and the center is ruled by ether. So the five elements. So you know there are certain places which are good for building, for planting, you know, so many things like that. And you know, you see that sometimes there's been floods and, you know, cyclones and what have you, and sometimes the only building standing is the temple or, you know, mosque, and that's because they quite often build according to the Vastu. They put their, you know, it's not by chance, you know, it's that they put it in a certain, you know, there's certain blocks. You can tell, it's not just, you know, you pick a block and then, you know, set it up, but you can actually choose what's an auspicious block to buy, what's not an auspicious block to buy. It has a certain, you know, the land has a slight slope to one direction, and, you know, there's, you know, all sorts of things. So you can recognize the actual land. And then achieving that land, you know that it's in an auspicious position, and then you can build auspiciously and fence auspiciously as well. But you do have to accommodate for the living entities who live or who may take up residence there, because, you know, there are ghosts everywhere. And you know, snakes and poisonous creatures, you can't just rid the world of them. You know, that's what That's the modern way of doing things, is that you build a house, and if you just put the concrete thick enough and concrete the ground, there's nothing living, and a bug wouldn't even want to come here. It's all dead, it's all solid concrete, we'll block, or we'll have air, just we'll make our own sort of type of air inside. We're not even going to let air come in just in case little bugs come in, Yeah, and plenty of chemicals around the place like that. We're just going to, de-life everything, So they're just us living here.
That should get
that. It doesn't work. They will revolt. Thereafter, cobras and snakes without hoods, large snakes, scorpions, and many other poisonous animals took poison out of the planet Earth as their milk and kept this poison in snake holes. They made a calf out of Tatuksha. Now, of course, keep in mind that all of these living entities have presiding deities who are, very, very intelligent persons with whole civilizations. There are naga or snake-like persons, I think, Bhima. Didn't Bhima marry Arjun? He married one of the Naga girls. Ulupi, yeah. You read that in the Mahabharata. They have whole civilizations. They sometimes live, beneath the, in the depths of the rivers or the oceans and places like that, or the ground. But, those civilizations, they also take care of the, other ordinary snakes and poisonous creatures and what have you. They're sort of under their domain. Yeah. If we become completely liberated from all fear and what have you, then we can be like Haridas Thakur. He lived in that cave, and there was a big snake there, right? Big snake. But we can't imitate Haridas Thakur. If things are done properly, that's why we do a Bhumi Puja. And, by doing the Bhumi Puja, and then daily, performing Jagya, Sankirtan, then we generally don't have problems from other living entities. That's what we're saying, that, by satisfying the root cause of all creation and all living entities, that supreme person who controls every living entity.
Yep. You're protected from snakes.
That's right,
yeah.
Because
if you go to the
snakes, then you can do Govardhan Puja. We set up myself and Sri Murthy set up a little Govardhan Shield, of course, with their altar. So every time we do a Jagya, people do Govardhan Puja. They walk around Govardhan. So they're being protected without their knowledge. But there are just following the normal daily life of a Vaishnava pretty much protects one from all these various things. Yeah. If there is some definite danger that a deadly, poisonous snake has, entered your premises, and it can become a life and death situation between one of the children or something. Then sometimes other measures have to be taken there. I mean, there's that pastime with Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, where a snake, a very poisonous cobra, had come into the temple in Mayapur, and there was a big commotion amongst the devotees. They weren't sure what to do with it, and Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, who was on the balcony, he looked down. I think Prabhupada was there at that stage, and Bhaktisiddhanta said, "Kill it." Even Prabhupada was surprised, But there are verses that even a saintly person, is satisfied to see a very envious, deadly sort of creature killed. That's yes.
That's right. Yeah. I've been poisonous and they've lived for centuries.
Yeah.
That's because of the drinking.
Friendly way. That's right. Yeah.
Rather than regard them as an enemy.
That's right.
And it's like when you're out bushwalking, you can see a snake, you can just walk over and you can hit it on the head.
Yeah.
And you don't have to do anything.
No. So in most cases, you don't have to. It is possible to live side by side. It's possible that they may go, but then, in some circumstances, I'd have to be removed. So you get a snake handler in, or you get a crocodile in your pool or something. Get someone to come, which happens, you'd be surprised.
There was an incident when I was in India with my Swami's ashram, where the snake was in the appeared in the one of the temples.
Yeah.
And they made such a commotion. They all gathered and they had to remove it. And they believed that if they killed it,
yes,
that telepathically this particular snake,
yes,
will call hundreds,
yes,
of its friends.
That's right. That's
so
right.
So they had such a big commotion. Mm. I had seen large snakes before, yeah, and they didn't even blink an eye. So this particular variety had to be removed,
yes,
taken out of the ground.
Yeah. That's right.
And they explained that.
Yeah, there are certain snakes, and people who are experienced understand that they have some sort of mystic potencies, and therefore in India the practice is if they do have to kill a snake, they cut its head off, even after it's dead. And they have to dispose of the head, because the partner comes back, sees the imprint of who killed it on the eye of the snake, and kills the person who killed it.
Okay, wow. Oh, the reflection in the eye.
There's an imprint, yeah.
The snake's partner. See the reflection in the eye.
So they have to dispose of the... If they do have to kill it, they have to... But in India, there's still persons, who know how to... Therefore, there's a mantra by Janaka Pandit that, you can tame a snake, a deadly snake, with herbs or mantra, but more dangerous than that is a human... Who an envious human, because you can't tame them by mantra or herbs or anything, And actually, Srila Prabhupada spoke to, I think it was Dr. Bose, who was a family friend, and he told him the story that when he had some medical students, So, you know, Prabhupada's telling the story in the 70s, and this happened sometime, you know, many years earlier. So he had medical students, and one day a snake came into the, you know, where the students were, and the doctor, the teacher, he called for a certain person who was a Muslim, who knew the art of charming snakes by mantra. So he came in, he chanted his mantras, and you know, he collected up the snake and took him out really easy. And of course the students, you know, it's very common amongst, you know, the Indian people at that time who were trying to get westernized, or, you know, that they wanted to reject, oh, this is all, you know, nonsense, that doesn't, they wanted to reject anything like that from the ancient scriptures. Oh, this is, you know, that's not scientific like that, you know. So he said, yes, you go and see. He lives in such and such a place. So all his students, you know, there was like a dozen or so, they all went there, and they went to this place of the snake charm, and they said to him, you know, like, what's the trick, you know, like, you know, this doesn't really work, does it? He said, yeah, there's mantra, you know. I said, no, you know, they didn't believe him. So what he did was he tipped over that box. He had some boxes with heaps and heaps of snakes. He tipped them over, and the snakes were all in the room. And the students were like, you know, these were poisonous, deadly snakes, and they were aggressive, and they, you know, they knew that any one of them could strike them. You know. And they said, you know, they were like absolutely freaked out. And he said to them, look, as long as I'm here, as long as I stay in the room, you've got nothing to worry about. Like that. And then after some time, you know, because he knew the mantras, he just collected them all up and put them back in. But they saw that this person had full control over those snakes. If he was in the room, they were safe. If he walked out, they would, you know, go on it.
Like that. So,
what was that? Yeah, there's a connection there between the poison that Shiva drank and the poison of snakes and what have you. That is it. I'm not confirming the whole thing, but we'll just go that way. Yeah, I don't know. You're saying that we're allowed to kill them because
they fall from poison from Shiva's mouth that dropped onto the earth.
So we're allowed to kill them because they're poisonous?
They came from poison.
No, there seems to be something missing there. There seems to be a few steps in that conversation missing, so we'll leave that. That's in the eighth canto. We're heading that direction. All right. So we've understood that all living entities, Bhumi is taking care of all living entities. And of course, you know, when we perform, you know, we follow this when we, you know, have festivals, we feed all people. You know, some people take a little prasadam home for their animals, and, you know, all the living entities who hear the holy name, they all benefit from it. The four-legged animals, like the cows, made a calf out of the bull, who carries Lord Shiva, and made a milking pot out of the forest. They got fresh green grasses to eat. Ferocious animals like tigers transformed the lion into a calf. Thus they were able to get flesh for milk. The birds made a calf out of Garuda and took milk from the planet Earth in the form of moving insects and non-moving plants and grasses. The trees made a calf out of the banyan tree, and thus they derived milk in the form of many delicious juices. The mountains transformed the Himalayas into a calf, and they milked a variety of minerals into a pot made of the peaks of hills. The planet Earth supplied everyone his respective food. During the time of King Prithu, the Earth was fully under the control of the king. Thus all the inhabitants of the earth could get their food supply by creating various types of calves and putting their particular types of milk in various pots. So, Prabhupada mentions here, this is evidence that the Lord supplies food to everyone. And it goes on to say, although the Lord is one, He is supplying all necessities to everyone through the medium of the planet Earth. There are different varieties of living entities on different planets, and they all derive the eatables from their planets in different forms. On the basis of these descriptions, how can one assume that there is no living entity on the moon? Every moon is earthly, being composed of the five elements. Every planet produces different types of food according to the needs of its residents. According to the Vedic Shastras, it is not true that the moon does not produce food or that no living entity is living there. So, Prabhupada says here that the Lord is supplying the necessities of everyone through the medium of the planet Earth, and he's also confirming that the various planets also describe, provide the various necessities, eatables, to the residents of those various planets. So, so the Earth planet is crucial or very, very significant, especially is a place particularly for the performance of yajñas. but that's not to say that other planets are not producing as well. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It definitely was.
Yeah. Guru Maharaj said there were pictures taken from there was the fake pictures taken from some film and some.
Yes. Yeah. You know, I think they've got they created a problem when they faked the moon landing in order to compete with the Russians and what have you, you know. But now they've got another problem is that, you know, they've lied. And it's when people understand such a lie, you know, then it's really, that one lie is enough to bring down that whole civilization. It's such a big lie, you know. So it's the sort of thing, you know, they go through documents and they can reveal that, you know, we cheated you here, we cheated you there, we did this 20 years ago, no one really cares anymore, you know. But that one is such a big lie, it's a keeper, that one. It's a one, you take that to your grave.
If they know it,
no one's saying anything. The people say you couldn't be because it would have to be such a massive cover up, but it's easy to cover up. Those astronauts. Like they
die. Yeah.
1, 2, 3, that's
yeah.
They have to die.
Yeah.
Basically,
it's not that difficult.
I don't know how we'll find out, but we found out because
it's here. We find out through Shastra. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a massive amount of lies, you know, in the course of history, and we learn them, you know, more and more as time goes by. You know, there are so many horrible things that have been done, or, you know, deceptions. You know, there are some things which are just so ridiculous. You know, they make those governments look so foolish that, you know, they're not the sort of things that are released. You know, there's just, you know, little things and big things. There was one, who was it? Was it the, I think it was the British. They trained dogs to carry bombs under the German tanks and to blow them up. You know, it was like a suicide, you know, kamikaze dog. And but what happened was, of course, they didn't have German tanks to train the dogs. They had English tanks.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so during the war, the dogs ran onto the English tanks and blew them up. You know, because that's where they were trained. Yeah, well, we're learning about it now, but, you know, these things come out, you know, 50 years later, just too embarrassing to, you know, tell, you know. But, you know, if you look at history, there is just such a, you know, so many lies and cover-ups. I mean, the whole thing is basically, you know, lies and cover-ups from start to finish. But, you know, that one with the moon, it's, you know, there are certain policies underlie scientific progress, such as, you know, religion is basically something backward and based upon, you know, so all these scriptures here, like what we're reading here, they're basically unscientific and you know, they're created out of people's imaginations for, you know, various, you know, things to satisfy their beliefs and faith, but scientifically they don't stand up. That's what they feel. They have to, for modern science to progress, it has to you know, have a very condescending attitude towards religion, because of what they're doing. You know, many of the things, most of the things that you know, science has brought to the world has benefited very greedy, violent, you know, selfish sort of persons. You can't say it's benefited the population of the world. You can't say that modern science has benefited the earth. You can say it is destroying the planet earth, you know. Our water, our air, our forests, you know, the basic necessities such as food and, you know, what have you, most of these things are diminishing day by day as a direct result of modern science. but, you know, there's a promise that it's okay, that, you know, it's better than anything you've had in the past. You know, that's another thing with science, is that, you know, they always, again, the lies about, you know, the past is that, what we learn about the past is that in all cases there was no trace of civilization. There was no trace of, you know, higher knowledge or elevated civilizations or societies. They will not... Therefore, you have so many problems in this modern world, but it's the best we've got so far. We've evolved to this point, and, you know, we have no record of anything, you know, better than this in the past. They don't want to have that. If there was a record of it, people would say, well, gee, if there was something, you know, very civilized and people could live in harmony with nature and we weren't destroying the planet, and people were happy and had lots of time and didn't have to work so hard, and the earth would produce. Why can't we do that? So they have to erase, you know, that sort of that. So, you know, for modern science to flourish as it is, it has to, you know, cover up, you know, and lie about the past. Otherwise, it can't flourish.
There were human footprints found billions of years ago, but all these facts have been just.
That I don't want to know about it. Yeah. And then, you know, there are certain, apart from, you know, covering up and lying about the past so that there's no competition. In other words, you may, you know, be very disturbed about what we've done to the world, especially because we're becoming, you know, a few of us are becoming very wealthy and, you know, and everyone else is sort of suffering. But don't worry about that, because there was nothing better in the past, and in the future, oh, there's so many wonderful things coming. Don't worry that we're going to destroy this planet, because when this is, by the time we've ruined this one, we're all going to the moon anyway. We'll go and live up there, you know, and Mars or, you know, Jupiter, whatever like that. So don't worry about that. And, you know, so there's always this post-data check of, you know, in the future, you know, we're going to make technology and machines so that no one will have to work. It'll all be done by machines. But the thing is that people are working harder with the machine. Now that we have the machines and the technology and the computer, people are working harder. You know, when computers first come out, they said, you know, you won't be using paper, you know, it'll save trees. You won't, there'll be no need for paper. We're actually using more paper now because of having computers than we ever did.
What about medicine promising like people to live longer lifespans?
When you'll live longer?
We've got people living 500,000s of years. And even in really, in current times, in really isolated places like in Japan, people living to 100, 620, very primitive lifestyles. So, there are all these promises of better things, but without any respect for the earth.
That's right, yeah.
Anything else.
And there's also, the other thing about science is it has the ability to dazzle. With, you know, there are some things that sort of really, oh, that was amazing, you know. I can't believe
it.
The moon landing is one, yeah. And there are a lot of distractions. Television, mesmerizing, radio, and, you know, going to the moon, rockets, and, you know, going in there. There's a lot of things which are just so fantastic that they've done that with it, you know, in cars. And they think, oh, you know, I can't believe it. They're so clever, you know, they must know what they're doing. But they utilize that false sense of authority that they've gained in order to use the same science to, you know, promote all sorts of very harmful activities as being safe. you know, for instance, I saw now, you know, the latest health advice is that pregnant women can drink alcohol in moderation, and there is no proof to suggest that it causes any harm to the developing child within the womb. And this has been scientifically proved by the latest, you know, medical.
By the research sponsored by the wine company.
By the wine, yeah, that's right. They happen to be sponsoring. And, yeah, you know, things like that, that, you know, they, if there's a certain amount of things where you can bewilder people that, okay, we used to have nice grass and trees and birds and animals, and now we've got roads, you know, and pollution and cars and accidents, and you know, you used to be able to walk across the road or down the street and go to work. Now we have cars, and practically, you know, you have to drive for 3 hours. You know, cars were meant to make it going to work was easier. Or, you know, now, even though we have cars, planes, trains that travel at the speed of light, it still takes you much longer to, you know, and just to see your brother or your sister or your mother, you know, it's like a couple of hours travel, you know, and you've got, you know, you've got to go through all the network of freeways and tunnels and what have you. But people dismiss all that because they've got this wonderful car. They can drive, you know, that facility to be able to drive down the road at 100 miles an hour, that feeling, zoom, 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 you know, like there's something, you know, there's something, you know, instinctive, you know, primeval, you know, satisfying, you know, that they're prepared to just block out the scenery that they're driving in now. You know, previously when you've got cars, you'd go for a drive in the country, or you go for a Sunday drive, you know, therefore we had the thing, Sunday driver, you know, people, they take their car out on a Sunday, otherwise they wouldn't take it out because they all work locally and what have you. A Sunday driver means you didn't have to take your car out until Sunday. You go for a drive. Because you only drive on Sundays, you don't really know how to drive very well. Oh yeah, Sunday driver, like that. You don't get Sunday drivers now, you know. So, and you don't go for a drive in the country. Because wherever you go, there's roads and freeways and things like that. But that feeling of driving in a car, people will block out the fact that we're going for a drive in the country, but it's going to be 6 hours before we see a tree, you know. And when we get to the forest, it's sort of, you know, it's fenced off in this little 1 acre thing, you know. You can go for a walk and like that. It was actually a song. Joni Mitchell, the Big Yellow Taxi, you know, they put the trees in the museum and they charge you $1.50 just to see them. You know, it always seems to go, you don't know what you've got until it's gone. Yeah. They put all the trees in the museum, they charge you $1.50 just to see them. Like that. So, but people will just somehow block that out just for that exhilaration. So scientists are very good like that. They can give you that instant thrill, and because of that people will say, okay, alright, we don't have any rivers, we can't breathe the air, you know, we're all dying of cancer because there's so many chemicals in everything, you know, but if I can drive up the road at 50 or 100 miles an hour, I'm prepared to forget all of that, you know. And in the future, I'll be flying to the moon. Like that. So, you know, there's a lot of lies, a lot of cover-ups about the past, about the future. And this Srimad Bhagavatam exposes all of it. You know, and like you were saying, you know, here, why wouldn't there be living entities on the moon? Because why wouldn't there be living entities on the sun? Because, you know, the scientists previously, they said that living entities could not live within a certain temperature, above a certain temperature that, you know, such as deep within the earth, you had the, you know, lava and this and that. Nothing can live, they said like that. That was the scientific fact, you know. And I remember as a devotee seeing an article in the newspaper. Oh, scientists have discovered life, you know, in such temperatures. And I thought, well, Prabhupada's been saying that, the Bhagavatam's been saying that for what, 5,000 years? And here, this is some big discovery. Like, you know, this is something I've known for, you know, so many years as a devotee. Prabhupada's known all his life. The Vedas have known, you know, because the living entity is not the material body.
Do you really talk about the centre of the earth? Because I've been dreaming a lot of falling into the cavity that takes me into the centre of the earth, and there's like other
There are living, yeah, there are all sorts of living entities. Yeah, look, we get little details, you know, here and there, enough to understand. Was it Ravana? Ravana tunneled through the earth from Sri Lanka to Brazil in order to extract the gold.
Yeah, yes, gold.
Yeah. So, yes, you know, there are living entities everywhere. Yeah. Because as long as a suitable body, you know, is made that can, the living entity itself, the soul, is actually, the life itself is, you know, can go into any body that's suitable for that environment, you know, so.
The soul is like, can't destroy by people.
That's right, that's a verb, yeah. That's right, exactly right, yeah. That's right, yeah.
The entities that are able to withstand.
Yes, really, yeah. Dense. Yeah. But if we know the science, you know, it's not that difficult, you know, just like, therefore, if you go to the bottom of the ocean, again, where they considered, you know, there's no life. You know, if you get to a certain point, there's nothing. But when they get there, you know, they send their little, you know, cameras and what have you, they see that these little fish and what have you, the pressure that's on them is something like, you know, having three jumbo jets sitting on top of you. You know, it's just this phenomenal pressure, and these little fish are swimming about. You know, anything else is just, you know, but. So therefore, even what's on this planet, the fact that living entities can exist in this molten lava, in the bottoms of the oceans, you know, where there's this massive pressure in so many different places, just proves that, you know, if the suitable body is, you know, there, whatever the circumstances, a living entity can live there. So there's no reason why, you know, living entities can't live on any planet throughout the universe.
Yeah.
There's so much life already, and what discovery are these scientists doing, if at all that?
Yes, that's...
what they're discovering is already there.
It's a poor man's imitation.
Yes.
That's... you know, someone created some machine that, you know, was able to make the sounds like barking of a dog. You know, but, there's already, you know, a dog barking, you know, so it's already been done, it's already been made, and it's far better than what the machine is, so, you know, what is the benefit, you know, to have a poor man's imitation, you know, then why don't they give credit to who created, the dog is barking. But, look, as far as travelling to the centre of the earth, there's a couple of movies there. I don't know, maybe those those NASA men may have been, you know, watched too many movies. But, you know, because as humans, we can only get so far into the below the surface, you know, in the oceans or below the, you know, and we just burn up. So they can only travel so far, you see. So, I think the deepest body of water is 7 miles. That's the, what do they call that? 7 miles deep. There's a Mariana Trench, I think it is. But you know, that's not very far. There was one man who's been down there back in the 1950s. And he created something and managed to just, there was a few cracks in his, machine, in his little ball type thing. No one's ever been back since. You know, with all the technology they have, it's so dangerous even now. So he went right down, and that's how they found how far it was, 7 miles. But, you know, there's not many people who have been very far, as I say, one man's been 7 miles down. That was the 1950.
Before the 2012 stuff about the shift of dimension, you basically put these articles on Facebook. It was meant to be covered up, and it was someone had in the 50s or something gone there, and some door had opened, and there was some crevice in the world, and it was very deep, and it was like a new dimension.
These things are possible. We accept that there are certainly living entities and civilizations throughout this universe, throughout this earth, and within it, within the waters, within the skies, within the various planets. We accept that. Sometimes, different humans do come across, civilizations, like what they call a portal or what have you. So, it's possible. But we can only, we're very careful just to repeat what is properly verified. So we're not dismissing it, it's possible. Things can be dismissed, though, if they don't make sense, as we're saying, that, if they said that they themselves went so far down and they didn't really have the proper, means to do that, you'd wonder, well, you don't have the particular body suitable for getting to that place or, what. So if people manufacture something, it's actually, if you know the Bhagavad Gita, it's easy to detect that. If they're saying something which in the realms of possibility, we can nod and not necessarily dismiss it, or it's possible, yes, within, but whether they've actually done that or not. But we're just generally very cautious about. We don't accept anything that's until it's there's a proper authoritative source. Yeah. There's so much stuff, yeah, and yeah. I mean, what we've read today is exciting and wonderful enough. That's from the ancient shastras, which is a verified source, which is accepted by all the great acharyas and saintly persons, accepted fully. So there's no necessity to accept things which are unverified, although they may be within the realms of possibility. But we're just very careful. Even, for instance, past life regression. And Prabhupada mentioned that he's heard about people, they go back in this past life regression. And we can understand, because of reincarnation, that people they may have memory from their past life. That's in the Bhagavad Gita. We know that people can do that under certain circumstances. So Prabhupada accepted these things are possible, but he also said, well, but we can't verify that, so it's not like we take it as an authoritative statement. So there's certain things like that. Within the realms of possibility, yes, that's supported by the Bhagavad Gita, but it's not properly verified, so we're just leave it, and really concentrate on things that verify it makes. And there's so much information, you're better off to spend your life just because it will take you your entire life just to go through, you know, what's in the Bhagavatam of that which is verified, and you'd be surprised. Those things which are unverified, they can absorb so much of your time, and it won't necessarily lead you anywhere. The beauty of the Bhagavatam is that when we read these various things, there, all this information is helping us to see everything in relationship to the absolute truth. Whereas even if something else is correct knowledge, it may actually be presented in such a way that it covers over the relationship between the absolute truth. See? So even it may be correct, but it can actually... So, you know, the Bhagavatam is very beneficial and therapeutic like that. You know, that always helping us to perceive the absolute truth and perceive the absolute truth as a person. Whereas other things, even if they're correct, they are generally presented in such a way that the personality of Godhead is covered over.
So, more interested in these things.
Yes, yeah. No, but it's good. Yeah, it's good to
show what funny things are out there.
No, I enjoy your comments and you know, both is all the students, because I will sometimes hear these things, and so I like to know what's, you know, being said and circulating, and it's good that when I hear them again, we've also had a little discussion, you know. So, all these contributions are very important, you know. They're very good.
Yes, because you've come in contact with lots of different people from walks of life. They always say different things.
Yeah, people. Yes, people. Pretty much, you'd be surprised. I, in the course of my week, the amount of people I contact, and you know, I talk a massive amount to people, you know. But
people have been offering cigarettes.
All sorts of things. But you know, especially for a devotee, because a devotee will quite often, in the course of a conversation, just mention a couple of things which are usually quite incredible. You know, even some of the common statements of a devotee will actually, where'd that come from? Like that. So sometimes people will want to, I know some incredible stuff. So, you know, they'll talk about that with you, you know, so things will come out. So, you know, you do hear all sorts of things, but it's good to, and especially, you know, for other devotees, everyone here, it's good for us to know what people think, what they're discussing, what they're interested in, what they see as, fact and fiction, like we were discussing about the moon.
Yeah.
You know, that, anyone here, does anyone here think they actually went to the moon? That you think they went to the moon?
Oh, no.
No, that's, no. Yeah. Yeah.
The moon.
No.
Not
really. Yeah. In a previous life.
In a very lucid dream.
Oh, that's right, yeah, you mentioned that, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's possible. That's astral travel.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
most
possible.
Most people think they went to the moon. Like, most of the community, they
really
believe it.
Yeah.
Like, if you
ask yes, a lot
on the street,
yes.
You know, or someone in Coles supermarket, yeah. They say, of course, what are you talking about?
That's right, a lot of people
crazy.
Do. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Most people can have votes count as well. Don't they?
Do they have votes count? Yeah, they do. They think the voting counts. Yeah, but there's a lot goes on behind the scenes that we're not aware of. Yeah. So but as you can see, this these topics of the as we go through the Bhagavatam, there's a lot of new information, specific information about certain things, but gradually as you get an overall understanding of the Bhagavatam, then it gives you a complete understanding of you know, the universe, the nature of this, the life force, spirit, and matter. Therefore, in Prabhupada's planetarium, you know, in Mayapur, you know, they're doing. He wanted that. They're doing that now, aren't they? Yeah. And it will have a, you know, so when people go into there, it will have a depiction of the universe and all the living entities on the different planets, such as we're discussing, in such a way that, you know, you can get a visual understanding, right, of that and different things. So. So that's another way, you know, to see it. So we're seeing here through the Bhagavatam. Let me see about that. The difficulty that people have who don't learn through such literatures as the Bhagavatam is that they can't distinguish between, you know, something which may be truth or something which is untruth. And so they may accept something sometimes is truth, and then they're not sure whether it is truth and reject it, you know, or they might accept something as untruth and then later accept it as truth. But, you know, there's a lot of backwards and forwards. So they're on very unsteady grounds. It's a very confusing world for a lot of people. The other thing is they don't know the interrelationships between one thing and another. Of course, there are very subtle sciences. As we, as we're studying the universe here, we've also looked at these different living entities in as far as their different levels of consciousness. See, generally, people from a material point of view, they would just look at civilizations from the physical differences and the geographical differences and what have you. Bhagavatam is ultimately about understanding levels of consciousness, material consciousness from the lower modes of the tamaguna, darkness, gradually up to the material mode of goodness, sattva, and from that platform of sattva or knowledge, one can then begin to understand spiritual consciousness, and then understanding spiritual consciousness, one gradually comes to the point of bhakti, which is the loving, conscious relationship between the Supreme Being and the spirit soul. And then that bhakti has many, many different levels like that. So as we're studying the Bhagavatam, ultimately it is a study which is bringing us to spiritual consciousness. That spiritual consciousness begins with that seed of faith in bhakti, and that seed, that conscious spiritual consciousness culminates in prema bhakti, or pure love of Godhead. So that aspect is not there in any other conversation, you know, that you'll find. So you can people will say things, we're not sure it's verified or not, but this aspect of consciousness, there is not even a trace of understanding. Not even a trace. So it's a very, you know, important. Therefore, in one sense, a lot of it is useless because it doesn't really produce a result except just it's
the pain is going the wrong direction.
Yes, that's right. That's a fact, yeah. Okay, are you looking at a particular verse?
I'm just looking at all Yep. You were saying that, you know, what we do here, we have to everything to satisfy the demigods, and there's a reciprocal relationship.
Mm.
In fact, we can't do anything unless the demigods allow it. Like, we can't even open our eyes.
Yeah,
we can't
swallow,
we can't
even.
Even
the blink of your eye, even the blink of your eye is actually controlled by.
Like we're totally dependent, and when we have no independence at all, we can't do anything without.
No, I disagree.
No, this is what the literature says. Yeah, that's my everything is totally under.
There's a picture in the Bhagavad Gita, right, of the demigods with the strings, like putting in puppets.
I just felt that sort of concept wasn't.
So you want to clarify the extent of control that may or may not be there.
Yes.
The demigods. Yes, the demigods. every movement of the body. You know, and then the elements, you know, nature around us is controlled by, you know, various demigods. This material body is something like a machine. For instance, when you purchase a car, when you purchase that car, you accept that a certain amount of the movements of that vehicle are predetermined. In other words, the pistons will go up and down. You can't say, "Oh, I'd like one to go out that way." You know, when you turn the steering wheel, the wheel will move, you know, the tyres will turn a fraction. They're set. That has been predetermined by someone else. So these bodies are like that, they're a machine. There is a certain predetermined thing that you can and can't do. So therefore, that control is there. At the same time, accepting those limitations, the driver within those parameters has a certain amount of freedom to do some things. A driver has a limited control. The manufacturer has, you know, set that car, it will go to a certain speed, it will brake, you know, like that. But the driver can, within those parameters, has a certain amount of independence. So it is like that. That we, the demigods do control every aspect of this body, in the same as the manufacturer controls every aspect of that car. But we can drive it in a certain way, but even when we're driving it with our freedom, we also operate within the laws of what's proper and what's not, although we can break those laws if we want. So in the same way that we're controlled by the demigods, in the sense that the body has predetermined movements, but we can utilize that in a certain way according to our freedom. But then the demigods are also providing us with religious do's and don'ts. And that's another restriction. That's another form of control that we can break or follow as we like. So it's like that. We free will and destiny are there side by side. Now the difference is, which you'll see as we study the Bhagavad Gita, is that the higher the elevation of the consciousness, the more freedom one has within the body one has given, and in how one uses that. You know, from the lower, darkest stages of ignorance. So a tree It's a very limited movement. monkeys. You know, for instance, Prabhupada was saying that monkeys in Vrindavan, he says if there are devotees, sadhus, who live in Vrindavan and they want to have sex life and at the same time imitate and advance devotees, so they're having sex life with this woman, that one, you know, causing trouble, having, you know, they take birth as monkeys. They're restricted. They can no longer have cause trouble in human society having sex with someone's wife. Who's going to have sex with a monkey? You know, it's been completely stopped.
These people already start to look like monkeys.
They do, that's a fact. So, no, it's a fact. So, the next birth, yeah, no, that's the next birth is coming. So, you know, they are restricted by the demigods that they can no longer have sex with their people's wives. But because they're attached to Vrindavan, they've probably served Vrindavan and served Krishna to some degree, so there's some benefit there, they get to live in Vrindavan as well. So there's a certain amount of restriction, there's a certain amount of freedom, but they can't, you know. So the material bodies that we're given are like that. They're completely controlled by the demigods. So even the freedom is controlled. So the monkeys are still free to have sex. But they're not free to have sex with someone else's wife. So therefore, their freedom is also controlled. So the lower the level of consciousness, the more your independence and freedom is also controlled. And the higher your level of consciousness, then the more freedom and independence you have, until such persons like Narada Muni, you have complete, you know, independence like that. Yeah. Does that answer that?
Yeah. Yep. So I think the only area of concern is that people think that they have, like, that complete independence and they don't really.
That's right, they don't.
That's my sort of, like, finding
That's why they're called, that's why the Bhagavad Gita says Mudha, what's that, 327. Mudha is like an ass, a fool, a rascal. Vimudha. They're especially foolish, you know, because they think they're independent, when actually they're controlled by the material modes of nature, which is being the three modes of material nature being operated by the various demigods,
mm-hmm.
under the supervision of the Supreme Lord, Vishnu, Krishna. And therefore Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that this material energy is acting under my supervision. But they're thinking they're independent. That is their. That's why they're mudhas or fools. Yeah.
And before, when you said if we worship or ask favors of the demigods for specific purposes, then it contradicts that
bhakti.
Bhakti,
yeah.
And also the devotion to,
yes.
to Vishnu. Is that?
Yep.
Mm.
Vishnu, of course, is non-different from Krishna. But when Krishna looks after the material world, in that capacity, it's like God is at the office. Then he appears as Vishnu. So, yeah.
You know, over my time with my love for India, I've got several deities in my house,
yes.
Ganesh.
Yeah.
Is that going against, going straight to the source? And is that something that...
Well, Ganesh is acceptable in that it's possible to worship Ganesh to ask him to remove obstacles on our path of bhakti. So, yeah. And Ganesh himself, he prays to Lord Nrisimhadev, doesn't he? So he's a devotee of Lord Nrisimhadev. So you can therefore worship Ganesh as a devotee of the Lord. You can actually offer respect to any demigod as a devotee of the Lord. But where, if someone sees a demigod as independent from God, that's where they may worship that demigod in a foolish way. Yes. But so you know, when a devotee worships or offers respect to a demigod, they may pray, you know, if there's some obstacles on my path of bhakti, you please help me. For the goal of bhakti, it's okay.
Okay, because I put it on the back of my car, Ganesh, so no one hits me from the back. That's not good.
Well, I pity poor Ganesh if someone runs into the back of your car, because he'll be the first. He'll be the first casualty. You know, most of the demigods are sort of mixed devotees. In other words, they're in the heavenly planets because they want to enjoy special facility, otherwise they wouldn't get there. But at the same time, they're servants of God. So, you know, they're sort of materialistic devotees. They're sort of at the very beginning. Some have some faith, some not much. But, you know. The next story is quite interesting about Indra because he becomes envious. But, you know. But there are other devotees who are, you know, the most elevated in bhakti. In other words, they have a very intense and completely spotlessly pure love for the Supreme Lord, either because they're Nitya Siddha, which means that they're actually residents of the spiritual world who sometimes come down to teach us, or they've come to that platform again, having followed, you know, a Nitya Siddha. If one associates or worships or offers respect to those pure bhaktas, it's said that all of the demigods reside within those devotees of the Lord. All of the demigods, including Ganesh, Shiva and Parvati, they worship the pure devotee of the Lord. The demigods aspire for that pure devotion. They don't have that, but they aspire that, you know, they have some motivation. And it may take them hundreds of lifetimes and many universal creations to come to that point. But these devotees, they're spotless, as we said. There's just pure love of a very completely transcendental. So the demigods actually worship those persons. So the point being that, you know, if you want to offer worship or respect, and if you want to please all the demigods, you simply worship or respect the pure devotee of the Lord, and all the demigods will automatically be satisfied with you. The other thing about the demigods is that they become envious, and we're going to see about this, because they have material motivations. Some of them. Themselves, sometimes each other, sometimes humans. Therefore, they will sometimes, the demigods, they are subject to envy. There was a point I was coming to there. I lost that point.
So we should just go to Krishna.
if we offer respect or service to the pure devotees of the Lord, all the demigods become satisfied. That was the point. If you worship a particular demigod, you actually have to worship all the other demigods as well. They get jealous and envious. She's worshipping Ganesh. And then Indra's thinking, why isn't she worshipping me? I give her so many benefits.
So then they might deny you of something, other demigods.
You can offend other demigods by worshipping that, yeah. Another point is that when you worship the demigods, they take exactly what you offer, your worship. So, if you worship the Supreme Lord in love, he accepts the sentiment you intend to offer. So just like if a child comes to you and the child wants to offer you a cake, and they make some mud and put some flowers in there and say, here's a nice cake I've made. You accept that because there's that loving reciprocation. If you go to the shop and you ask for a cake and they give you some mud and some things like that, you say, what's this? The relationship between the demigods and those who worship is very specific. If there are faults in your worship, then you can get an adverse reaction.
Mm.
you kind of offended them.
Yeah.
Mm. You have to be very careful worshipping them. What's he made of?
Quite extravagant.
Okay, you can take him out again and put him where, and if you chant Hare Krishna, he'll enjoy that. That's what you have to do.
But it was definitely a turning point in my life.
That's right.
It had an adverse.
Yeah.
Especially ceremonies and things are done a bit specifically for you. That would be more powerful as well.
Yeah. In this day and age, it's actually not possible to worship the demigods other than chanting Hare Krishna mantra. It's not.
I think Nataraj is the time of distraction.
Nataraj is a form of Lord Shiva who he's specifically the god of destruction.
Does that dance during destruction, isn't it? Is the same?
Yeah, Nataraj.
I think, as Prabhu pointed out, my advice is if you put Srila Prabhupada's statue,
yes.
Even more powerful enough. In other words,
for instance, if you had a little murti or a picture of Prabhupada, and you just give Prabhupada a little flower and chant Hare Krishna, then Lord Shiva, your Nataraj, it would be completely satisfied. You don't have to do anything else. There you go. All right. Let us finish here. Next week we'll have a look at chapter 19. Hare Krishna.
Oh, okay.